Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with Israeli strategic analyst Jonathan Conricus. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I could continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. So, just hours after the diabolical Hamas attacks on Israel, the morning of October 7th, 2023, retired Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus reported as a civilian volunteer for reserve duty and was appointed as an IDF Reserve International spokesperson. Having served 24 years in the Israeli Defense Forces, including 4 years as international spokesperson from 2017 to 2021, he was just the right person for the job. He remained in that distinguished position until the end of 2023. And in those grueling 3 months, he encountered an endless barrage of interviews, briefings, and events. Covering all time zones and media outlets, Jonathan conducted 30 to 40 interviews with top-tier news services every night, and then went on to fill his days with Zoom calls, meetings, and diplomacy. His service to his nation was tireless, unwavering, and deeply inspiring as he educated us all on the truth about Israel and their defensive and existential war in Gaza. Despite the media's relentless anti-Israel bias and aggression, Jonathan never lost his cool, never lost his composure. As the voice of sanity and rationality in a hostile and sometimes anti-Semitic world, he reminded us daily, many times a day, how and why Israel is fighting this war, and why, no matter what, Israel must win. Jonathan Conricus is a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, focused on the Middle East. He served in the Israel Defense Forces for 24 years as a combat commander in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip. He also served as a military diplomat, foreign relations expert, and international spokesperson. He recently retired as Lieutenant Colonel. Jonathan was the first Israeli officer to be seconded to the United Nations, during which he provided military and strategic analysis for UN peacekeeping forces. He has directed social media and public diplomacy efforts and has extensive on and off camera experience from his years as a spokesperson. That being said, fair warning, in about half an hour, he has an interview with the BBC, and he had a choice between going on BBC or just staying with me. So we're going to be taking a brief break while he does pop off. In about half hour, he will be back. What's it like to be the most important spokesman in the world today for the state of Israel?
Well, first of all, shalom, and thank you for having me. I don't know that I am. I think of myself as someone who fights for the Jewish people and is engaged in representing the state of Israel unofficially, the Jewish people, the IDF, basically Israel. I wasn't appointed by anybody. I do this because I believe in it. And I think that it is very important. And whenever I can influence, whenever I can be on air and explain the situation on the ground and combat bias and misunderstandings and lazy reporting, I'm always happy to do so.
Always the diplomat. Lazy reporting is exactly the kind of words that you use that make me chuckle. But you do have an extraordinary knack for diplomacy. So that being said, I just want to ask just sort of a personal question. Facing so much contention in the media space, not to mention the world diplomatic space, you always stay so calm in the line of fire, so calm that it's really quite astounding to watch, to be honest. Now, you were doing this also under the extraordinary pressure of working 24/7 23 hours a day. So I'm wondering what kind of toll that took on you in those 3 months, emotionally, psychologically, because it's not just the work, it's not just the hours, but it's the aggression.
So I'll tell you how I dealt with it. And to keep myself to kind of put things into perspective for myself, I constantly reminded myself that I'm not under fire. I am physically safe. Nobody's shooting at me. And I'm in a safe location. So therefore, no need to get excited. And unlike my friends who were fighting in the battlefield, unlike so many other Israelis who were called up for reserves and who were at the time getting ready to fight in Gaza or already deployed and fighting in Gaza, I told myself, well, you're just speaking to a camera, and maybe sometimes on the other side of the camera is a less than friendly person, but that's it. So that helped me, keep things into perspective. And I think that perspective is important because so many times people in media and people who see themselves on screens and on phones, they kind of get confused about what really is important. The essence is what happens on the battlefield and what our brave men and women do there to defend the country. And then people like me and others, we have a role, and I suppose that you have as well. I don't know how you feel about it, but we definitely have an auxiliary role in order to support it. So that's one thing that kept me into my own perspective. Second thing, it is sometimes it felt almost relentless to be under constant attack by journalists who were snarky, cynical, underinformed or misinformed or misinforming about the situation. And it was a lot of negativity towards Israel. And after, you do 20, 30 interviews, at some stage, you might subconsciously start to believe in the line of questioning that you're being presented with all of the time.
Really?
Yeah, because you're repeat
You
something
start
is
second guessing yourself.
exactly. I think that's a natural thing. And then what I found myself doing was every once in a while, I would actually watch a few seconds or a minute of the horror movies, the clips that Hamas terrorists filmed themselves on the 7th of October, going into Israel, massacring Israelis, burning, killing, executing, and doing it with tremendous joy. Once in a while, I'd used to watch that again and get myself
To
focused and
remind
to
yourself.
remind myself what this is about. Yes, journalists, they will have many journalists, not all of them, but many journalists will have a narrative that they will be promoting, which essentially is Israel is to blame for whatever is happening. Whether you started it or not, if you didn't start it this time, it's because something else that happened 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, you are to blame and you had it coming. And as such, let's now explain why Israel is responsible for what's happening and how you are responsible for civilian suffering in Gaza and in Lebanon and in Judea and Samaria and Syria and Yemen and maybe the blackouts of power in Iran as well. So every once in a while, personally, I actually needed to kind of galvanize myself in that aspect, and I found that useful. And it was there were times when it was challenging. And what I found helpful was also, I don't do yoga like you, but I did a lot of sports and training just to get the aggression out of my system. That helps me stay focused and more composed when speaking with people. And I think those two tools are what helped me.
Now, you're doing this on such next level, but I can't emphasize how important this response is because There are so many people who are afraid to speak up for Israel right now because someone might say bad things, or they might lose a follow or many followers. I've lost tens of thousands of followers over the years. Every war, because this isn't my first rodeo, and I'm a yoga person. It's a very anti-Israel community in general, the far left. But overall, like you say, as long as we remember why we're in this fight, I think that everybody needs to get to that place where they feel secure in fighting the fight.
Yeah, but for that, I think you touched on a very important topic. I watched, you know, these horror clips of Hamas terrorists murdering Israelis. That isn't why I wake up in the morning. That isn't why I fight. I fight for the continued prosperity of the Jewish people in its homeland, right? But I needed that negativity to make sure that I was on check with reality, because many journalists have a different reality that they're trying to shove down my throat and viewers' throats. And that's why I needed it. So I think you touched on a really important topic that I think many Jews today, still after October 7, they still maybe haven't asked themselves what it really is that they're fighting for. Because fighting against anti-Semitism is one thing, but fighting for the prosperity, the safe living, the success, and the general, you know, the success and happiness of the Jewish people in its homeland, that is really my objective. And I think that a lot of Jews, they define what they're doing in a negative or a complementary way, as in, I'm combating anti-Semitism. That's also good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that a lot of people, they struggle to say out in the open, yes, I support Israel.
Jewish state.
Yes, Israel isn't perfect. The politicians are far, far, far from perfect, and nothing is perfect. But this is our home. This is what we're defending. And sadly, still today, many Jews aren't comfortable speaking up and doing it. And I commend you for doing what you are doing now and what you have been doing, a brave voice. People in your circle, as you say, yes, are not inherently positive towards Israel.
Again, the diplomat in action.
They're not positive towards Israel and our independence in our ancestral homeland. For some reason, people have issue with this one successful indigenous movement of people that was able to reclaim its homeland. Many other, when you say indigenous, you think of people who sadly lost, right? You think of Indian tribes, you think of Indian or Native American, well, never mind the terminology, of original people in Australia or Canada. They end up being a plaque in a reserve, right? The Jews aren't a plaque. We are not, you know, the original custodians of this land. Yes, we are that, but we also came back and we own the land now. It is ours and we are nurturing it and doing well for ourselves and for others. And a lot of people have issue with that. And I think that is something that we need to remind ourselves of. This is what it's about.
I'm laughing because the last question I have for you is, what does Am Yisrael Chai mean to you? And I think you just answered it.
Yeah.
So we'll be able to fast forward at the end. Sorry, past that question. So, I mean, obviously you are a master, not just of diplomacy, but of communications. And as such, you have, like many of us, criticized the Israeli communications machine. I just stacking on what you just told me now, because we've all talked about Israeli PR, and my question in the aggregate is it that the Israeli PR strategy is failing, or is it because no one is listening? But I also want to stack on what you actually said. Does the communication have to be directed not just at informing the general public, but also at informing the Jewish, particularly the diaspora, on, like you say, why this isn't just about fighting, but supporting a cause?
So I think, first of all, there's a lot of politics involved. And I think that the current state of affairs in Israel, is a direct result of a political decision that has weakened Israel's public diplomacy and media efforts. And instead of investing in it, instead of prioritizing it, instead of earmarking intel capabilities to support media efforts, and instead of putting it front and center and defining it as a strategic enabler for the state of Israel, that hasn't happened. And what we have is basically an amateurish effort. Lots of well-intended people in Israel and many, many well-intended Jews around the world are trying to help in the fight. But until Israel decides that this is an important strategic issue that we are going to prioritize, then I don't think that we will see substantial change. Having said that, we are facing an incredibly difficult uphill struggle. It is an unfair playing field or fighting area. I think that the media landscape in the West is generally rigged against Israel. It is predispositioned negatively against Israel. And we are treated unfairly, held to impossible standards in each and every way that you turn the conversation. Yes, anti-Semitism is live, kicking, biting, screaming, and scratching all across the Western world. We see it on campuses, we see it in schools, we see it in town squares, and we see it very dominantly on social media and in traditional established media, newsrooms, editors, etc. It is definitely everywhere. And if anybody thought that by being nice Jews, by assimilating, by looking like others, by adopting the social codes and behaviors that others, non-Jews, have, that would create lots of love for us and it would spare Jews from anti-Semitism, I think we can agree that after October the 7th, that fallacy was exposed and that theory isn't working. Which brings me to education. And I think that, you know, the people who watch your show and many other people, you know, people ask me about the future of Gaza. How long is it going to take? And, you know, how big is the problem? And if I, you know, when I give an honest answer, which is what I always try to do, I say that it's a matter of education and that this will take a generation, at least one generation, to change and fix. Conversely, in Israel and in the Jewish world, I think we're facing also, first and foremost, a problem of education. And I think that we as Jews would be much better off if the unity and the strength of the bond within the Jewish communities around the world was stronger, where Jewish organizations first and foremost said, acknowledged and recognized and put it at the center of their policy that we support Israel. No matter, or almost no matter, what Israel does or who is elected prime minister or whoever minister is in power, Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. And we as Jews in LA or in Toronto or in Canberra or Sydney, we support Israel. We're proud of Israel. It's our ancestral home and we support it full stop. If that will change and if that will be the voice coming out of Jewish communities, I think educationally, that will take away a lot of the noise and a lot of the negativity, because frankly, I think it's very, very damaging when you have Jews who don't support Israel and undermine Israel's legitimacy. And I'll say one other thing about that. You know, when doctors take their oath, right, they first commit to do no harm, right, and then try to alleviate suffering and promote health. I think the state of Israel also, internationally, in terms of its relationship with international Jewry, should first have a posture of do no harm and try to help Jewish communities into strengthening the bond with the state of Israel, with the official state of Israel. And I think that the state of Israel hasn't been doing this successfully over the years. So it's a two-way street. It's Jews around the world, in America, Canada, Australia, France, many other places, UK, that first and foremost, whether their neighbors like it or not, should feel, believe, and act and connect to the state of Israel. That's one thing. And the second would be for the state of Israel to be much smarter and better in its actions and its communications to Jews and other people around the world.
And I do feel as if this is the message that Isaac Herzog is very much messaging right now, especially I feel as if with all the discontent swirling around Netanyahu, he's not even in a position to share this message. Like if Trump says, oh, we all need to, you know, we all need to hold hands and sing Kumbaya, 50% of the world is still going to go, ew, get me the sanitizer, right? So I do feel like this is something that President Herzog is focusing on right now.
Yeah, I commend President Herzog. I think he's a very good voice and representative for the state of Israel. I think his statements are good and conducive. They definitely are, I think, a very moderate, sane, morally strong voice representing the state of Israel. But to be honest, he is not the most important voice.
Of course.
The most important voice and the actions and the executive power rests with the prime minister. He and his ministers are the ones who set the tone. They are the ones who define budget priorities. They are the ones who allocate resources. They are the ones who define the national priorities. And their priorities are not identical with President Herzog's.
Sure, of course. I know you have to take a break in a few minutes, so I'm gonna throw you one more question, hopefully before you go to some lesser appointments.
To the competitors.
The competitor, that's right. BBC, they just keep posting about how it's so hard for them to compete with me, and
yes,
here we are.
Yes.
So as we all know, the Israel has just approved a plan to go into Gaza and reoccupy Gaza. Tens of thousands of reservists called up if a hostage deal is not reached by May 15th. Again, depending if we're back into drib and drab world or if we're looking for 59 hostages, I think that remains to be seen. Obviously, international condemnation is going to be
has already started.
So I guess my question is, can Israel afford to care about the UN and international opinion, in or the reverse? Can Israel afford not to care about that opinion?
So the short answer would be no, Israel cannot afford not to care. I think Israel cares. Israel cares because Israel in general, Israelis, want to be on the right side of morals. And we want to not only do the right thing, but be seen and appreciated in doing the right thing. And Israelis are very frustrated with how we are portrayed in international media and how we are shamed and ostracized by various corrupt UN institutions and a very biased international court system, legal system against Israel. And that bothers Israelis. We're not a country, we're not a people of people who don't care. We do care. So at the basic level, we care and we want to, we want reality to be reflected fairly. And again, you know, I'm not saying that everything is perfect. Any country that is engaged in combat and fighting defends itself. And when you defend yourself, yes, mistakes also happen. And I think Israelis want wrongdoings to be looked into. And we want our military to be of the highest possible moral standards in the world. That's our aspiration. It becomes a tainted and loaded dialogue when you know that the beginning of the conversation is already You are conducting genocide and apartheid, and you're trying to mass murder, and you're doing wholesale crimes against humanity and war crimes. That's like the starting point of the international legal debate. That doesn't promote a lot of willingness to listen and really to be open for criticism. And that's the situation that Israel is in. Israel is a small country with around 10 million people, with a strong and vibrant and resilient population and a strong economy. But we're a small country that relies on imports and international trade and the support that we have from the United States of America and trade with other partners. So no, we cannot allow ourselves to be disconnected from it and not care. We have to listen and we have to operate within the realm of possible. I think we have a window of opportunity currently with the current American administration for Israel to do more. President Trump said multiple times, if, and this was about 3 months ago, if the hostages aren't released, all hell will break loose. Go in there and get the job done and do whatever you need to do. That was said multiple times,
sure.
And Israel hasn't done that because Israel is still trying to get our hostages back and save as many people as we can. I think going ahead, what we will see is there are a few things that will be like forks in the road. One, the next one will be if and when the IDF will start distributing food in Gaza. If it does that, that will be a direct threat to Hamas's governance. And what that will do, in my assessment, is that it will force Hamas out of the tunnels, and we will see significant fighting against Israel, against the IDF, because then Hamas will be under threat. I think that other things are also in store. If a deal could be made with Egypt, and Egypt could be persuaded either by stick or by carrot to open the Rafah gate and to allow Palestinian civilians out, that would be a strategic game changer. And that would mark really a new chapter in the history of Gaza, because that would provide an opportunity to get rid of Hamas really long term and then actually to start to rebuild it. But as long as Gazans are trapped inside, as they're kept there very cruelly by the Egyptians, then the possibilities to really rebuild and, you know, change the trajectory and build a different future, I think, are very limited. We'll put a pin there for a few moments.
Okay. So for those of you who are joining late, Jonathan is going to pop off for a few minutes to go talk to my main competitor, BBC News. And meanwhile, I will keep you entertained with some personal commentary off the top of my head, totally unplanned. And we'll see you in a few minutes.
Yes.
So one thing I do want to talk about here is the fact that the hostage situation is, I believe, a lot more complex than the way the world seems to be approaching it. For those of you who have been watching my other podcast with Andrew Fox, which is called A Paratrooper and a Yogi Walk into a Bar, which is candid conversation about the Middle East and the war in the Middle East, a point that I was talking about is that everyone says we can't both win the war and get the hostages back. And of course, this is the conventional wisdom and it makes sense, except for one thing. The hostages are honestly the only bargaining chip that Hamas has left. Okay. The only reason that this war took more than 2 or 3 weeks in the first place is the hostages. Right. So Hamas knew that when they came in and took 252 Israelis, that Israel was going to be relatively hamstrung on what they could actually do in retaliation because, of course, they wanted to protect the lives of the hostages. There have been some utterly tragic, sickeningly tragic, friendly fire incidents that even more than a year later make me physically ill to think about. But just like everything in this war, I feel as if, I don't feel as if it's true, the world has lost sight of what war is. You hear a lot about double standards, and when it comes to Israel, triple standards. There's no standard that is matched in the world for the way that the microscope that Israel is held under. Okay, this goes without saying. So the errors that have been made, as tragic as they are sadly normal for war, just as things like civilian casualties are normal for war. But to get back to my point about the hostages, I don't think I have to tell you out loud that live hostages are worth more, so to speak, than murdered hostages, right? Like, if we can only get 24 hostages out of 59 out, we're going to try to get the 24 living hostages. So, what does this mean for Hamas? It means that, in a weird way, Hamas has as much of an incentive to keep those hostages alive as Israel does. Now, for Israel, of course, it's a deeply personal and emotional issue. I know I'm not alone when I say that I think about these hostages all day, every day. I don't exaggerate when I say that I wake up crying every day, realizing that they're suffering another day, and their families. I it's impossible to imagine. And it's so gut-wrenching to endure. Of course, Hamas, there's no love lost between them and the hostages that they are keeping in brutal captivity. Their desire, which is, I would say, even a need to keep the hostages alive, is going to be based on the fact that if they want any remaining bargaining chips against Israel, they're going to have hostages to give back. This is very, very significant. So what we've seen some videos of Hamas literally, they're propaganda videos. They may or may not be true, of course. But it seems as if there are videos of them deliberately taking the hostages and trying to keep them safe from perhaps Israeli bombing, or even just any other form of danger, of which there is much in Gaza right now. So one thing I was thinking about this morning, however, is, let's say that Hamas has the incentive and the capability to keep all of the hostages alive, the remaining hostages up to 24, as we found out during a faux pas by Sarah Netanyahu, it's now believed there are fewer than 24. Perhaps that just means that they don't know what happened to Idan Alexander. Hamas claims that, they've lost contact with his captors. Again, everything that Hamas says needs to be taken with a grain of salt. But with 24, let's say, live hostages, are their lives going to be better if they're kept like Gilad Shalit for 5 years alive in torturous conditions? Or is it going to, I can't finish the sentence. We're just going to pray for the best for our hostages. Now, for those of you who are just tuning in, Jonathan had to step out for a moment. He has an interview with the BBC that happened to coincide with this interview. So unfortunately, BBC gets priority over the Yoga of War podcast. However, he's just in the other room and he will be back in a few moments to continue our conversation. I also want to let you know, particularly those who may be new to the podcast, that I have this week, this technically is my 50th episode. I'm so honored to have had the astounding conversations that I've been able to have with so many of the world's top illuminaries these past since July. You can count the months, and have so many amazing voices coming up. Today's episode was a complete surprise to me. I met Jonathan on Sunday and he agreed to very graciously come on the show today. My intended 50th episode, which will be in 2 days on Thursday, is going to be with Sagi Dovev. Do you know who he is? If not, I recommend right now that you Google him. Sagi is a miracle worker. There's really no other word for it, who is taking severely injured IDF soldiers and also working with some of the released hostages and bringing them back to life, giving them life again through resilience training and Krav Maga, and also just his amazing and huge heart. Jonathan Conricus is here. He's going to be back in just a minute or two. He's finishing up a brief interview with the BBC, but he will be back. One other point I want to bring up about the hostages is that, as we mentioned, Israel has threatened to go in and reoccupy Gaza, right? If a hostage deal is not ascertained by May 15th, coinciding with Trump's trip to the Middle East coming to a close. Now, I'm getting a lot of sort of mixed information about whether that means all 59 hostages home, if Israel is really, truly, and honestly ready to play hardball with Hamas and say, you're going to go along with our terms, or we're coming in and this is going to spell the end for you? Or is Israel, for the sake of getting out whatever hostages they can alive, going to be willing to go back to the dribs and drabs formula of the first stage of the ceasefire? Now, given the military gains that Israel has made since the end of the last ceasefire, I personally do not believe that they are going to be willing to step back at this time and like they did in the first ceasefire and withdraw, even if it does mean the release of some hostages. But as Jonathan was talking about, and again, for those of you who are tuning in late, Jonathan had to step out for a quick interview with BBC. He will be back in a few moments to continue this conversation. But as Jonathan was talking about, the Israeli public is They're destroyed. They're destroyed over the hostage situation. And most Israelis in polling have said that they actually prefer getting the hostages out and basically giving up the war effort to continuing the war effort in hopes of getting some of the hostages out. This is an impossible calculus, right? Because if we save 24 hostages, and God willing, we save 24 hostages, and God willing, we get the deceased murdered hostages home for a proper and respectful burial as well. But if we do that at the cost of Hamas staying in power, like we did with Gilad Shalit, 1,027 hostages, prisoners released for one hostage, among them Yahya Sinwar, not just among them, but Sinwar's life was actually saved by Israeli doctors. If it weren't for that hostage exchange, it begs the question whether 10-7 would have happened at all. Exciting news. Jonathan is back, fresh from his conversation with the BBC. And let's get back into it.
Yes,
Okay,
let's.
quick question, because I think you might have some insight into this that I'm getting very conflicting information online about, which is when Israel is saying we need a deal by May 15th, is it going to be 59 hostages or we're going in, or are they going to accept the drib and drab formula again?
What I understand that the Israeli establishment, military and mostly military, is saying that if you, Hamas, hand over 59 hostages, live and dead ones, and you agree to surrender, you lose the war, you surrender, you disarm, the war can end now. All of the suffering, all of the alleged things that are happening in Gaza, what people are going through, and all that we hear. That can end the moment that you, Hamas, as the aggressor, as the organization that invaded Israel unprovoked on October the 7th, murdered 1,300 Israelis and took 251 captive. If you lay down your weapons and return our hostages with no other conditions, then this can end. And we won't need to send 50,000 troops into Gaza and destroy what's left of the infrastructure and flush out the terrorists that are hiding in their tunnels. That won't be necessary because we will achieve our objective, which is a very just and reasonable objective, not to be threatened by a terrorist organization in Gaza. If we, think, will they take this and will they respond to it? I wish that they would feel and care about the future of their own people, whom they claim to represent, and that they would weigh things on that balance and that scale and say, well, if we do take this offer, then we will save lots of people and prevent lots of suffering, and it'll be good long term for the people. It won't be good for the terrorists, but it'll be good for the people. But then again, those were never the considerations of Hamas, and as such, I don't think that they will take that deal. But I think Israel does right in first presenting an option, a diplomatic option. And if it isn't accepted, then military action.
But do you think that they'll be willing to accept a deal that takes five hostages or releases five hostages or 10 hostages in exchange for a fort, basically a return to phase one, maybe without the disengagement piece? Maybe they keep a military presence but don't disengage. Are they gonna, because in phase one, it was let's get whoever we can get home, home.
Yeah, so I think that there are, as I alluded to before, there are certain issues that are really crucial for Hamas. Without Egyptian support, strategic Egyptian support, Hamas doesn't exist. If the gates at Rafah are opened and people are allowed to voluntarily leave, that will threaten Hamas's governance and that will really pull the rug underneath their feet, and that'll change the situation. If and when Israel starts distributing food in Gaza and creating an alternative to Hamas's distribution and Hamas's control over aid, what Hamas basically is doing is leveraging aid in order to remain in control over the population. They're recruiting young Palestinians on condition. That's the condition for which they get food for their families. So if these three things happen, then that there will be a strategic challenge for Hamas. If they don't happen and it's only military force, kinetic operations, then I think that the kinetic military force option, it'll take quite a lot of time and it'll be very ugly, very violent. We will have casualties, sadly. I wish we can prevent all of them, but I think sadly we will have casualties, and they will have lots and lots of casualties, terrorists, and unfortunately also non-combatants. So what I think morally, you know, many times people, including the last conversation I just had with the BBC, the first claim is about Israel's responsibility, and they read me a long quote from UN organizations that accuse Israel of weaponizing humanitarian aid, and they give a long list of why they won't cooperate with distributing aid to Palestinians. And I said, that's extremely rich. You know, these are the same organizations who claim to be humanitarian. If they really were humanitarian, if they really cared about Palestinians, the number one claim that they would have would be allow Palestinians to leave. Why are they kept in the battlefield? Why are they forced to stay in a combat zone? No other people in history have been forced to stay in a combat zone against their will, only the Palestinians. So all of these organizations who allegedly, reportedly have humanitarian benign goals and serve a higher value, well, if that is the case, then your number one priority should be to allow people to leave. And just like in every other war, famine, horrors, whatever, you move people aside, you establish facilities, a refugee center with food, electricity, medical supplies, and logistics. And then they're there until the situation improves where they came from, and then they can go back. That's how people, that's how it happens all around the world. Only the Palestinians are different. They are held hostage by an international aid system, UN institutions. Their whole working model is that they have to have their subjects imprisoned in Gaza, the Palestinians. They're held there by the Egyptians, and they are oppressed by Hamas. And then Israel gets the blame for it.
That's right. If we want to talk about the weaponization of aid, it's not of Israel stopping to send aid that is being stolen by Hamas and used to fund their weaponization against Israel.
Yeah.
It's Hamas and the UN that is weaponizing this aid. And this is the inversion that follows the entire war.
I'll tell you something that is, I found it really amazing. This was the early stages of the war, October 7, the attack, and then we started to mobilize reserves, and the IDF was getting ready to invade into Gaza and attack Hamas. Israel, what Israel wanted to do was to evacuate people from the northern part of Gaza, Gaza City, and to have them concentrated in a humanitarian zone. The first thing that Israel did was to approach UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, and all of the other so-called humanitarian organizations in Gaza, and tell them, this is going to happen. We don't want civilians in the battlefield. We don't want to kill them. And in war, people who are in the wrong place at the wrong time, they face consequences. Mm-hmm. We don't want that. So we'd like to move everybody out, and we're asking you for your help. The amazing response was, no, we are not going to help you evacuate civilians. Think of that. That is, it's unheard of, right? A humanitarian organization who said, no, we're not going to help evacuate civilians from the battle space. Now, how could that even, you know, how come there isn't a board of inquiry inside the UN, Department of Peacekeeping Operations, the DPA, Department of Political Affairs, the General Assembly, Security Council? How come nobody's investigating that decision?
Because they're the UN and they have an anti-Israel bias. They answer the question.
Yeah, but I mean, They're supposed to be protecting Palestinians, right?
Absolutely.
And that decision by UNRWA, UNICEF, and many other UN institutions and programs, that has killed tens of thousands of Gazans. Imagine a situation where before the first Israeli invasion of Gaza, after the attack on October the 7th, before that happened, they would have helped people evacuate out of Gaza. And Gaza would have been virtually empty of non-combatants. Imagine how different the war would have been, how short it would have been, how few casualties they would have had.
The hostages, though.
What about them?
If there was no one there but Hamas and the hostages, the whole reason that this war, I believe, has taken more than 3 weeks is because of the hostages and our considerations that now it seems are going to have to be finally put on the back burner to an extent in putting the mission of defeating Hamas as the number one priority.
Yeah, for the
but
first
it hasn't
time.
been.
No, it hasn't been. And for the first time after almost a year and a half, the prime minister has said, in his words, what in my mind was clear a long, long time ago, that you cannot achieve both of these aims simultaneously. I've been wearing the hostage pin for more than a year and 3 months, ever since I took off my uniform. I've been hoping for, praying for, and acting for the Israeli hostages to be released. And I feel the pain of the families. I can't imagine what they're going through. And I don't even want to try to put myself in their place. It must be the most unbearable suffering, especially for a parent. And I don't criticize any of the of the families. I think that that level of fear and frustration and anger, I only wish that their loved ones would be brought home safely. Having said that, and having understood that, I think that at the, let's say, cold, rational level of strategic decision-making, for the first time, the prime minister said something that many people have been known to be true, that we cannot achieve these two goals simultaneously. You cannot both destroy Hamas and get the hostages out alive. Something has to give, and there has to be a hierarchy of objectives. And as horrible as it is, and as heart-wrenching as it is, that is eventually the decision that Israel needs to take. Israel can capitulate to Hamas's demands and say, okay, you know what, we stopped the war, give us the hostages, and we'll commit to not fighting Hamas in 5 years. Israel can do that. But what that, I think, will bring will be tremendous danger and suffering for Israel at the strategic level.
Yeah.
Not only the suffering of the families, whom I again hold dear to my heart and I respect them very much. It's not about that. It is about strategic decisions for the state of Israel and going forward.
It's Sophie's choice, right? I mean,
it's
we've
the worst
faced it.
Solomon's dilemma. Yeah.
Okay, yours is biblical. Mine's a little like Hollywood, but same concept.
Yeah.
I know that you have talked a lot about Egypt, and I feel as if Egypt has basically gotten a free pass in this war. Like it's amazing how few people are talking about Egypt. I think that my concern is not just how they are facilitating Hamas's terror. There's also the issue of that probably, I say probably because Israel is sort of trying to almost cover their asses in this, but they've probably violated the peace treaty by mobilizing their quite formidable army, right? And this puts us in a really precarious place because up until now, Egypt has really depended on U.S. support, right? It's the reason that, let's be honest, why they have peace with Israel. It's like, okay, well, you know, America is going to give us this money. They're giving us these security assurances. They're giving us this military support. However, I believe in this day and age that if U.S. said, okay, no peace, if you don't want to uphold your part of this agreement, we're bailing. And they'll be like, okay, hey, China, Russia, Iran, and those countries are going to rush in to fill that void. And so removing the US commitment is nothing near the threat that it used to be. And then to the east, of course, we've got Jordan, right? And it's already a very unstable government with a predominantly Palestinian populace who is very anti-Israel. They are, it seems, teetering on the verge of collapse. And so in a scenario wherein one or both of these countries, God forbid both, Egypt and Jordan, decide to back out of their peace agreements with Israel, which they have both threatened at this point, what is that going? You don't think that's serious? Okay.
No, I don't think it is. I think that those peace treaties, each one separate, Egypt and Jordan, they're very important for Israel, and they are very important for our counterparts. I think that we have to distinguish between Egypt and Jordan, two different
Sure.
cases, very different balances. I am far more worried. I mean, there's room to be worried about both countries because there's potential threats and dangers that emanate from both of them. Egypt, in the direct sense, they have a large standing military that they pay a lot of money in order to maintain. And then you ask yourself, why does Egypt have that military? Because they don't have any real threats. Not to the west of Egypt, Libya, no military there for thousands of miles, and not to the south, Sudan. No military there for thousands of miles of desert. So why does Egypt need a very big military, standing military, not reserves, with lots of advanced weaponry? One asks.
And by the way, I mean, Israel has never in any way threatened Egypt. So we're talking about a war of aggression should this occur.
But I do think that the peace treaty with Israel is a founding strategic pillar in Egypt's national security. I agree with your analysis that yes, there are options to US assurances and US power, but I don't see the Egyptians doing that because it wouldn't only be replacing one superpower with another, which is, an old trick in the book. That's the game the Egyptians played all out through the Cold War between the Soviets and America. Eventually, America won, Israel won, and Egypt took the side of the winner. I think that what Egypt is getting away with is burning the candle on both sides. On one side, Egypt allowed weapons to pass through Sinai. And was all of the weapons that Hamas used on October 7 came through Egypt with Egyptian authorities knowing about it and profiting from it. And then on the other hand, Egypt gets international credit for brokering ceasefires whenever there's fighting between Hamas and Israel, and that brings them a seat at the table. Before October 7, Egypt was spiraling out of control, its economy doing terribly, and nobody was really interested in what Egypt was doing or wasn't doing. Now they have a seat at the table because they have influence over Hamas because they are the ones who allow them weapons. Now, like with so many other things, I think that the problem starts in Jerusalem. The problem starts in Israel, where there is still this October 6th conception or paradigm of thought that is very, very careful about the Egyptians, and that we mustn't rattle or destabilize the Egyptians, and that we mustn't put any pressure on the Egyptian system so that it doesn't collapse and turn into total anarchy. That's basically the boogeyman, the strategic boogeyman that many Israeli decision makers still are beholden to, I think wrongfully so. And I think that is why we Israel, haven't been applying tremendous diplomatic pressure on Egypt to open the gate in Rafah. As long as we don't apply pressure, nobody else will. The US won't apply pressure before Israel says that this is our number one priority. Hello, dear friends in Washington, D.C., Prime Minister speaking here. This is my list of priorities. Number one is for there to be incentives for the Egyptians to open the gate because that is the best way for the war to end. Sadly, as far as I know, that hasn't happened. And as long as it doesn't happen, then of course Egypt will continue to get away with murder because they're not paying a price for it and there's no consequences. On the contrary, they're scoring global goodie points for being mediators, which is absurd. They have skin in the game, they are part of the problem, they facilitated the growth of Hamas. So, by the way, did the Israeli government, but they facilitated the growth of Hamas, and now they're also reaping the benefits from it in ways of negotiating. So, while of course we have to be careful and prudent is the better word, and keep our strategic objectives front and center, we don't want to jeopardize the peace treaty, not with Egypt and not with Jordan. But then, on the other hand, we shouldn't cut us or sell ourselves short and undermine the war efforts in Gaza. By Rafah remaining closed, we are undermining our war efforts in Gaza, and it will take us longer and more casualties and more work to get the job done.
Okay, let's go to the north because we've got so many directions to go in. Lebanon. And you're gonna have to help me with the president, the pronunciation of his last name.
Aoun,
Aoun.
Aoun.
Oh, okay.
Aoun.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
Aoun. It
Yeah.
sounds like Aum, which
Yeah.
is like a yoga thing.
Oh no, it's on. Yeah. On.
So, how sincere do you think he is about disarming Hezbollah and sort of dismantling them? Do you think that Hezbollah is going to have an opportunity to regroup and rearm in the near term? Do you think that they may lay low during his presidency and see what comes in time? Like where do we see Hezbollah heading like in the near term, like the
Yeah.
next 5 years?
So for American viewers, to explain how volatile that topic is that you just discussed in Lebanon of Hezbollah's arms or who has arms in Lebanon, that in my mind would be as if you rolled immigration, abortion, and
And
gun
gun control,
control in
yeah.
one topic. For Lebanese in a Lebanese perspective, that's what we're talking about. So that's not a small thing that the newly elected president, in one of his first policy directives and indications where he is going in his presidency, says that the state, only the state, the Lebanese state, Lebanese army, will have weapons, and not Hezbollah and not Hamas and not Islamic Jihad and all of the other Iranian-backed terrorists that are ravaging the country. That's a brave move. I wish him great success, A, because that would be better for Israel, and B, because it would be better for Lebanon. And I think that a stable, functioning Lebanon is an Israeli interest. We have no interest in it continuing to being a failing and failed state where the Iranians are able to go in and use everything in their advantage and exasperate the suffering and the situation. And that kind of strategy isn't something that you say and then walk back. It's a very big issue. So I think he is now committed. He has taken that path. He will have to follow it. And I hope, and I think he knows that he has, and he will have American and French support for it. Without
And
it,
French.
yes, American and French. Without it, it'll be extremely difficult for him to do. And I think that what he's also counting on is that Hezbollah won't have the ability to transfer weapons through Syria. I don't think he would have made the same statement had the Syrian Bashar al-Assad regime still been in place and the Iranians still had the open highway in Syria. Because then the question of how will Hezbollah get their weapons back, it would have been easily solved. Now they still have an issue. Hezbollah has a strategic issue. And returning to your other part of the question, are Hezbollah going to lay low? Hezbollah are at their weakest points that they've been in about 25 years. And they have a strategic issue in supply, where they don't yet know and they haven't yet established, and it'll be difficult for them to establish how to resupply bulk. Yes, they can get suitcases of money over through Iranian flights and smuggled in vehicles and trucks, etc. Mm-hmm. But bulk, missiles, explosives, rockets, metal, you know, big shipments, that's an issue for them.
Will they go rogue like Hamas did, though? I mean, you know, Hamas was making missiles out of water pipes. I mean,
Hamas, no, that's old. You know, Hamas, I think we can sadly give them credit for developing a domestic military industry, which, yes, it isn't on par in a light year compared to Israeli or American, but it produced lots of rockets that were quite capable of inflicting damage. So I wouldn't belittle what they have done. And I'd say that Hezbollah over the years, with Iranian guidance, engineering advice, they established a serious infrastructure in terms of manufacturing of weapons on Iranian soil, most of it hidden in tunnels, either underneath Beirut or in the Bekaa Valley or along the border area between Lebanon and Syria. These are three clusters of areas where we know that there are giant tunnel complexes that Hezbollah had. Most of them have been bombed by Israel and taken out of commission, but some of them do still exist, and that is what they did over the years. So they're still, this isn't over by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that Hezbollah are in a problem and that this is probably the best opportunity that the Lebanese state will have to actually regain its sovereignty and monopolize the use of force.
And maybe restabilize a country on the verge of complete
As they
violence.
Say in our region, inshallah, God willing.
God willing. I mean, meanwhile, we have tens of thousands of internal refugees, right, from both the north and the south. Israelis in the north, in the border communities, we'll say north and south, are largely afraid to go home, which is a de facto cessation of sovereign territory if we're not meaningfully populating it. So what is it going to take for the Israeli populace to not only be willing to not only feel safe, but to want to go back to these border communities and rebuild and take back what is already ours?
Yeah, along with the failure of October the 7th, which is mostly military, but it's political, strategic as well, along with that failure, I think this failure to rebuild and repopulate and reclaim all parts of sovereign Israel is what, in my mind, is the second most severe failure of this government. And I am extremely, extremely disappointed with the priorities, the work ethics, and the general energy and accomplishments of this government in doing exactly that. Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. It isn't about killing Haniya or Nasrallah or Sinwar or Khamenei in the future. I don't know. No, it's not about that. Yeah, it's not about that. It's not about killing the enemy. It's about Jews living in their homeland safely, securely, and there being a positive growth in population and a sense of security for people. Mm-hmm. That is what it's about. Everything else is secondary. Everything else is supposed to support that. And what I am extremely, extremely disappointed with this government is that it doesn't appear to have that at the heart of its priorities and focus, not in terms of budgeting, not in terms of action. And, you know, maybe a government spokesperson will tell us and inform us that, oh, actually, they're doing very much and there's budgeting and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I care about results. And mm-hmm. I, as an Israeli, want to see Israeli homes rebuilt, mm-hmm. infrastructure fixed, and economic infrastructure put in place and incentives provided for Israelis to reclaim their homeland. People who live there on October the 7th should have been able to go back already and live safely in their homes. And the fact that it hasn't happened is, I think, the second biggest travesty of this war from an Israeli perspective.
Is there a differential between living safely and feeling safe?
Of course, that's a subjective sense, and one feeds the other. If you can be unsafe, but if you feel safe, then that is what eventually matters on the ground. Currently, Israelis, judging by their actions, they are not feeling safe in many of those communities. In some places, the infrastructure has been destroyed by relentless either Hezbollah or Hamas fire at their homes. There are entire towns, Metula, Kibbutz Margaliot, and many other places that sadly have still not been rebuilt. 50-60% of the houses are untenable. And that should have been fixed long time ago, in my point of view. That should have been a national priority of this government to fix those houses and allow people, first and foremost, the basic conditions to go home. Mm-hmm. And second, the sense of safety is the most important thing. Physically, I think it's safe to return to the southern part of Israel, the Gaza envelope. In terms of the threat on the other side, it is greatly, greatly diminished. It is much safer now than it has ever been in the last 25 mm-hmm. years. And in the north, it is safer, but it's not yet as safe as it needs to be.
But how does the IDF regain the trust and faith of the public after the failures of 10/7?
By winning.
Isn't that simple? Because on October 6th, I would say that we were already in a place where, you know, we were secure, we were safe. Do you think that if they win, people will feel like it's not going to happen again?
No, that's one and basic condition. That is first and foremost to win. Mm-hmm. Second is transparency and to accept responsibility mm-hmm. and accountability for the failures. Mm-hmm. This has started to happen. And I think most of the senior Israeli IDF commanders who were responsible have taken personal responsibility and removed themselves from their positions after they led operations successfully against Hamas and Hezbollah and the Syrians and Houthis and Iranians and whatnot. So that is important. I don't think that has been completed yet, but mm-hmm. we're perhaps moving better. I'd say that the disposition of the general notion in Israel is that, you know, we have only one IDF.
Right.
There will be governments that will come and go, prime ministers, as talented as they may be, they will come and they will go. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, there is one institution that provides security for everybody. That is the IDF. And it will have to improve significantly. It will have to show mm-hmm. which measures have been taken in order to be better. And it will have to earn the trust of the Israeli population over a continued period of time. This is personal for me as well. I'm going to be sending my children to the military soon, like so many other Israelis are. Of course, that's a conversation we have. Every parent, that is really a dilemma. But at the end of the day, you know, even if I have lots of criticism, tremendous criticism mm-hmm. and blame about how the IDF operated, how the government directed the IDF, and how the Ministry of Defense operated, and how Israeli commanders in the IDF operated, and how they failed to uphold their responsibility and perform their basic mission, defend the people, defend the country. Having said that, in terms of options, there really is one option. Yeah. We have to continue to fight. We have to demand of the IDF to be better and improve. And we have to continue to support it because that is what ensures the existence of the state of Israel.
Sure. I do want to touch upon Iran, but that is like the biggest topic in the world. And now you're getting scared. Are you going to be here for the rest of your life? So I just want to just touch our toe in it.
Yeah.
Can we just talk? I want to start with the Houthis in not getting into all, because people can see you talk about this mm-hmm. in amazing ways on YouTube. They could look that up. But my real question is, you know, Trump has
For people to be aware, all of my interviews, they are on YouTube of FDD's YouTube channel, fdd.org. And every interview that I do, we are very strict about having that online. So it's there for people to be able to view. And indeed, lots of people do.
And the link is in the show notes to that anybody wants to, not in case, they will. So Trump has made it very clear that in his eyes or his threats, as viable or unviable as they may be, he has said that he is going to take any more Houthi attacks as attacks from Iran itself, and that he's going to reply in kind, which mm-hmm. Of course he hasn't, but let's put that aside. Do you think that the Houthis ultimately, given this advent and the fact that they have just escalated the war with their attack on Ben Gurion, or at least the broader grounds, are they going to be the linchpin on whether we go to war, whether the US, sorry, we, the US decides to go to war against Iran
In short,
or take action against them?
I don't think that that the US wants to engage militarily against Iran. And luckily for the US, they have a partner in the region, an ally in the region that is willing and capable to defend itself, and to actually take action against its enemies and against the enemies of the United States of America. And that is Israel. Unlike many other American allies who are freeloaders and don't pay their own share, don't spend on spend the required amount of their GDP for defense and rely on US taxpayers' money and US troops to secure them, that isn't Israel. Israel defends itself. Israel puts its own blood on the line and defends itself, and Israel isn't asking for anybody else to do its heavy lifting. What Israel needs are the military capabilities to do so. If we could develop a B-2 bomber or B-52s and we could manufacture them ourselves, then we probably wouldn't be asking for them to be delivered by the US or to loan them or lease them or buy them from the US. Sadly, that isn't the case. But I think from an American perspective, a lot of times people, isolationists in the US, they criticize Israel as if Israel has influence on US decision making and as if Israel is dragging the US into a war. I think that's laughable. And I think that out of the various allies that the US has in the world, Israel is by far the best, the most loyal, and the most steadfast ally that the US has that doesn't waver and fights. Fights and does well for US interests. Israel serves itself, but it is also serving US interests and it is defeating enemies with American assistance, and that does very good for the US. So, with regards to Iran, I think that I hope that Israel will be given the assistance it needs in order to take on the Islamic Republic of Iran and in order to really put the October 7 attack against Israel, which was started by an Iranian proxy, and then the entire Iranian ring of fire around Israel started to attack Israel. Israel needs to bring that back home to Iran, and Israel needs to make the consequences felt by the Islamic regime. And until Israel does, I don't think that the Iranians will stop. They will continue to terrorize Israel. They will continue to do whatever they can and to use whatever expendable assets that they'll find. They'll find useful idiots. These are other Arabs that they will find, whether it's Lebanese, Palestinians, Jordanians, Syrians, whatever. They'll find them and they'll use them cynically against Israel until Israel will put down its foot and say, Khalas, enough. And these are con there are consequences for what you have been doing and what you think that you will do against Israel. And I think we're getting near that. Slowly, painfully, we're getting near it. And eventually we will get there. And then that will be a new chapter in the history of the Middle East. Hopefully, I'll be able to come back then and we'll discuss it afterwards.
Deal or no deal is 2025 the year that the Iran nuclear infrastructure is definitively disengaged and dismantled?
I don't think that there will be a deal. I think that the Iranians, the cunning Iranians, are want to use negotiations as a shield against an Israeli strike. But I think that the current prospects are basically a JCPOA 2.0, and that's a very bad deal. Bad for the US, bad for Europe, bad for Israel, bad for the Middle East, good for the Islamic Republic of Iran. So that's a very bad thing. And if it happens like this, and if there's enrichment capabilities left in Iran, and if there isn't a full dismantling of the nuclear program, then it's a bad and dangerous deal, one that I hope doesn't happen, and one that I hope Israel will have the ability to undermine or countervene.
So as the Iranian Ring of Fire continues to be extinguished, what do you see as the prospects of Turkey stepping in to create the next Octopian Islamic or semi-Islamic empire and terrorist threat to the whole region?
So I wouldn't put them in the category of terrorist. I would put them more in the category of Muslim Brotherhood, in the sense of a slow and gradual taking control of societies, institutions, in order to put into place Muslim rule, Muslim dominance. That's how the Muslim Brotherhood operates. And Turkey is operating according to those lines. Turkey has an imperialistic mindset, expansionist imperialistic mindset in the region. They're all over the place, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Egypt, in the Horn of Africa, in Gaza, Judea and Samaria, Jerusalem, Jordan. Wherever you look, you find Turkish fingerprints trying to meddle in local affairs in order to strengthen themselves as a result. The interesting area is now Syria, where there's a real risk of confrontation between Turkey and Israel. I think both sides, Turkey and Israel, are aware of the risks, are aware of the deficits and the downsides of having that confrontation, and are trying to prevent it. But what I think Israel is doing is sending very clear messages to Turkey that we are not going to have you establish an Islamic state in Syria under HTS, Muhammad al-Jawlani, or his current, Muhammad al-Shara, but Jawlani. We're not going to allow that to happen, and we're not going to allow the building of a new threat from our northeast. So that could get dangerous, but I think Turkey, ever since they were scorned by the Europeans, when Turkey applied several times for membership of the EU and were rejected, that set them on a different trajectory, which they are currently on, led by Erdogan, which is a hostile one, imperialistic and Islamist one.
So, oddly to me, if not to you, Turkey is still it is a member of NATO. So, okay, I'm gonna zoom out for a moment. So no matter how you slice it, the world right now is splitting into two camps, right? So we've got an alliance of Western democracies, and we have an axis of what I would call evil. Countries like Qatar, Egypt, Jordan, and even Syria are still choosing sides. Meanwhile, Russia's in Ukraine, threatening Eastern Europe. China is threatening Taiwan. North Korea is threatening South Korea, and Iran and its proxies are threatening everyone. Are we already in World War III?
No, I don't think we are, and I don't think that we will find ourselves. I don't think that the Chinese are interested in getting involved in the Middle East or in significant military adventures, and I don't think that the Russians have the stamina or the available resources to expand war in other areas. Yes, the Middle East is volatile. Yes, many things are dangerous, and there are lots of negative forces that have been awakened or unleashed. But I also look at the current security situation and I compare ourselves to October 6, and I think that we're in a much better position today than we were a year and a half ago, if we will have the clear leadership, foresight, and vision, and of course, the military capabilities to actually leverage the achievements that we have made so far on the battlefield. And I'm speaking specifically about Iran. Currently, where we are in the big scheme of things, in my opinion, is that we have done a lot of the legwork, but we haven't capitalized on it yet. And if we stop now, then it'll be a tremendous underachievement, because eventually the Iranians will roll back our achievements, and we will find ourselves again surrounded by Iranian proxies that are equipped, armed, and lethal, and want to play part in the destruction of the state of Israel. If we do, however, find that vision, strength, and leadership to continue to push forward and really turn the downfall of the 7th of October to a strategic victory that can be done with a few more prices that need to be paid, but that can be done. And then I think we will make a strategic change for Israel for this generation. And I think that's where we are currently. Very, very important times, but I think we have a window of opportunity still there with the current American administration, with the current achievements of Israel on the battlefield and politically, to actually deal with the root source of instability and violence in the region, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran, and to confront it. Confront it in such a way that scales it back or perhaps destabilizes it totally.
Let's hope that this momentum continues. And in more than anything, let's pray for peace.
Yes.
Jonathan, I don't know how to thank you enough for sharing this time with me. And this conversation has been the honor of a lifetime.
My pleasure. And I wish you all the best. I wish the viewers great success, and that we stay focused together, that we remain true to our cause, and that we continue fighting with pride.
Amen.
Shalom.
Am Yisrael Chai.
Indeed.